Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week on Bruderhof Radio, new commentaries from Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist and death row inmate.
For hundreds of people, the very act of assembly, of free speech, of protesting against state and corporate policies means arrest, jailing, and in some cases, convictions and sentencing, all for acts said to be protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
As we near the one-year anniversary of the protests at the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, countless media organizations will be recapping the year when mass protest once again seized the imagination of thousands of students, workers, and activists. The massive protests in Seattle and Washington, D.C. against international financial institutions, and in Philadelphia and Los Angeles outside the national political conventions, signaled to many the rebirth of direct action and a reawakening of an American public which had previously been too apathetic to protest much of anything. But while it is heartening to count the thousands who turned out for these demonstrations, it was equally disturbing to see the violent police repression of demonstrators. In Seattle, Washington, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles during the past year, tear gas, pepper spray, and rubber bullets were repeatedly used on nonviolent protesters. True, not all demonstrators were nonviolent, but the violent police response, which was applied indiscriminately to protesters, was by all accounts excessive and harsh. At the same time that many were protesting the environmental, social, and political dangers of the globalization espoused by the World Trade Organization, and as many others were demanding that control of American politics be wrested away from corporate donors and given back to the people, a growing movement has sought to expose the increasing frequency of police brutality, not only at mass demonstrations, but on a daily basis in most major cities of America. Every year on October 22nd, thousands of youth in cities like New York, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and San Francisco join a national day of protest against police brutality and repression. In addition to the much-publicized cases of Abner Louima and Amadou Diallo in New York in 1997 and 1999, there are thousands of similar examples. An organization called the Stolen Lives Project has documented over 2,000 cases of police brutality since 1990. And who can comment on police brutality and state repression of free speech better than an imprisoned journalist who faces censorship on a daily basis? Today, on Bruderhof Radio, we go inside prison walls to hear from death row inmate and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal about the growing culture of resistance to corporate power and police brutality. Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. He was sentenced to death and has been in prison ever since. But Abu-Jamal's supporters, including Nelson Mandela and Amnesty International, say his trial was riddled with judicial misconduct and bias. They say police tampered with evidence and bullied and harassed witnesses. They point to the fact that as a teenager, Abu-Jamal was a member of the radical Black Panther Party and that the FBI started collecting information on him when he was 16 years old. They point out that in the years immediately preceding his arrest and conviction, Abu-Jamal had become an outspoken critic of police brutality and racism in Philadelphia, using his career as a radio journalist to expose the violence of the city's police department. But whether Mumia Abu-Jamal is guilty or not, he remains one of the most passionate critics of racial and economic injustice in America. He has written 2 books while behind bars, and in recent years has recorded numerous college commencement speeches over the telephone. In addition, Abu-Jamal regularly records commentaries for Bruderhof Radio, and today we share his thoughts. The following piece was recorded on May 9th and is titled The Damning of Dissent.
All across the nation, hundreds of people and ultimately thousands of people are involved in protests against state or corporate policies and activities, and therefore they're acting on their alleged First Amendment rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution contains a provision that states, in essence, that Congress shall make no law abridging the free exercise of speech, and further attesting to the rights of the people to assemble for the purpose of seeking redress of grievances against the government. Every school child can quote these sections. So interwoven are they in the American framework and traditions of so-called law. Yet for hundreds of people, the very act of assembly, of free speech, of protesting against state and corporate policies means arrest, jailing, and in some cases, convictions and sentencing, all for acts said to be protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. If someone can be punished by the state for the mere exercise of a so-called constitutional right, then there ain't no such thing as a right. If one is punished in the name of a right, then one is wrong for doing that which is right. From the Seattle demonstrations to the Mumia demonstrations and on to the D.C. anti-WTO IMF demonstrations, protesters are punished for their beliefs by a state that disagrees with the very content of their message. Where is the right? That famous baby rapist and U.S. President Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "I have a right to nothing, which another has the right to take away." Spoken like a true slave owner, eh? Yet there is truth in his words, for they illustrate the limits imposed by governments against rights that they oppose. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the famous Buckley case, equated money with speech in finding that a law that limited political ads limited free speech. Thus, the wealthy and those with financial resources can buy speech over every network, every TV station, and every radio station, and every media available. For the poor, however, and those without resources, speech is an expensive commodity. For them, for trade unionists, for activists, and those even remotely in opposition to the corporate state, speech may be many things, but free it ain't. For many protesters, the right of redress and assembly is more than a legal inconvenience, for they were not just arrested, mugshot, convicted, and sentenced. They were beaten, brutalized, and in fact, terrorized by the state for their nonviolent practice. What can the words written on the U.S. Constitution, no matter how glorious their promise, mean to them? What can a court victory mean? What can any of it mean to men and women in Chicago, Minneapolis, San Francisco, and D.C., who were beaten by agents of the state for their protests? What people learn from these experiences is that the courts are not their courts, and that the agents of the state do not serve their interest. They learned that the words written in Philadelphia in the 1770s, no matter how gilded, no matter how deified, no matter how hallowed in their traditional national memory, are only words. I think it was Judge Learned Hand who, when a litigant complained about an injustice in his proceedings, lectured from the bench, "Young man, this is a court of law, not of justice." Like something out of a cheap grade B movie, the people who dared to protest against the state's death machine were ordered to surrender their passports, and the government was henceforth to be instructed of any of their movements anywhere in the country. Free speech? Freedom of protest? Free assembly? For well over two centuries after the founding of the U.S., the Constitution promised to protect the rights of all in the nation. Well, of course, that didn't pertain to African Americans. And for a century after the U.S. Constitution was amended to include blacks, the 13th and 14th Amendments, the courts spit on the amendments, ignoring, restricting, and misreading them to ensure white supremacy and the repression of a black rural labor force. The clock has changed, the scenes have changed, and the restrictive spirit of an ancient time now restricts the First Amendment to little more than a dead letter.
In the aftermath of the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia in early August, where hundreds of demonstrators were arrested and jailed for days, Abu-Jamal recorded this commentary.
The German socialist Rosa Luxemburg, in her book Reform of Revolution, wrote, "People who pronounce themselves in favor of the method of legislative reform in place of and in contradistinction to the conquest of political power, a social revolution, do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer, and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for surface modifications of the old society," unquote. As the nation's Republicans and political leaders had their feasts and festivities of opulence and splendor in the shadows of poverty, deprivation, and want, Philadelphia hosted hundreds of demonstrators from a variety of movements who each and all came to register their strong disapproval with the status quo and who opposed the repressive state of affairs. What is infamous southern epithet, outside agitator. Demonstrators were called anarchists, and some ridiculous media outlets seemed to whisper that they were terrorists. Similar media hyperbole will no doubt be projected at those who protested at the Democratic Wealth Fest in L.A. Why? Because the media, certainly now more than ever, is a tool of wealth, and as such, the instrument of those who rule, the wealthy. When people challenge the status quo, no matter how vicious, no matter how vile that status quo, they are opposed by those who benefit from their status. There are few Americans today who would dare to criticize the late civil rights leader, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., now lionized. At the time of his early ministry of protest, he was criticized by virtually every major news outlet in the nation. It took the rise of unapologetic militant activists like the late Malcolm X and the fiery young lions like Stokely Carmichael, later Kwame Ture, H. Rapp Brown, now Imam Jamil Alameen, and the revolutionary Black Panther Party to make the Reverend Dr. King look appealing to the rulers and their media. For his national campaign of protests, however, he was frequently condemned by the press for being an outside agitator. When the French bourgeoisie and workers were rebelling against the crown, Philadelphia's own Benjamin Franklin, an ambassador, and Virginia's Thomas Jefferson were, quote, powerful alien subverters, unquote, of the French government. French historian Pierre Croissot wrote in the French Revolution of 1932, regarding Franklin's influence, quote, his house at Ponce at once became the headquarters of the agitators. He was the high priest of the philosophers, the messiah of the malcontents, the patron of the framers of all systems. People wrote to him from all quarters, begging him for advice, unquote. In France, Franklin was an outside agitator, spreading dangerous and subversive ideas about the uselessness of kings in the land ruled by Louis the 16th. A young French lawyer was inspired by him and dedicated his first speech in court to the American. That lawyer was Robespierre, one of the most radical of the French revolutionaries. Today, who calls Franklin, Jefferson, or Thomas Paine, who was made a French citizen after the revolution and elected deputy for Pas-de-Calais, outside agitators? The great African-American scholar, Oliver Cox, wrote in his book, Caste, Class, and Race, in political class conflict, the ruling class will always be intolerant. Speech is never free to be used as a threat to the reign of a political class, unquote. Now, isn't that precisely what was shown in Philadelphia, the so-called Cradle of Liberty, which threw over 400 men and women into their most vile dungeon, Holmesburg Prison, the second oldest prison in America? Didn't they show this when they hit young protesters with fines of up to $1 million called bail? For daring to exercise their alleged rights of free speech and protest, they were denied every other so-called right imaginable. For true revolutionaries, there is no outside. For boundaries of race and of caste, and of language, gender, and nationality fade into the commonality of human and indeed of life. To the state, which draws its very meaning from social conflict and separation, nothing could be more dangerous. We must all learn from this and build from this, for revolution isn't a dinner party. It's a struggle to really transform and change things. Let us begin.
You're listening to Mumia Abu-Jamal on Bruderhof Radio. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, give us a call at 1-800-778-8461. That's 1-800-778-8461. Or visit us on the web at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. As Abu-Jamal says, revolution is a daily struggle. But for millions of people in America's ghettos, living under daily police harassment, Life itself is the struggle, never mind revolution. And as allegations of systematic brutality and evidence tampering continue to arise in the Rampart Police Division in Los Angeles, Abu Jamal recorded the following piece.
Every day, a cop places a hand on the Bible, swears to tell the truth, and lies with utter abandon in a courtroom in every city in America. The judge doesn't blink, the prosecutor doesn't stutter, and the so-called justice system swallows another body to the labyrinth. There's even a word for it, testa-lying. What has occurred in Los Angeles in recent months has only shown a sliver of light on a department-wide and indeed nationwide practice. Why does it occur? For the simplest reason ever. It works. A recent LA Times piece covers a wide range of overt injustices in daily practice. The big question is, do the police regularly lie? Some police administrators and legal commentators believe that police often tell small lies, mostly to justify unlawful searches, involving claims that officers saw a defendant drop drugs on the ground when an officer actually turned them up in a search of the defendant, or because he merely saw the drugs lying near the defendant and inferred that they belonged to him. That, the LA Times. As the scandal arising from the LAPD Rampart Division spreads, people are finally beginning to question the words of sworn officers. Theoretically, the sight of a uniformed, decorated cop on the stand, hands raised to be sworn, is proof positive to most jurors that the truth is about to be uttered. Theory, however, is rarely practice. This was revealed in the infamous Serpico police corruption hearings in the 1970s era New York. The later Mullen Commission hearings in corruption 2 decades later, the Christopher Commission hearings in L.A., and now the widening Rampart Division scandals, and what of the 39th District in Philadelphia? Decade after decade, scandal after scandal, commission after commission. And what has changed? In city after city, in case after case, cops take the stand and say whatever is necessary to ensure convictions. Judges, prosecutors, and juries alike see and understand what they are seeing, but it matters little. In a culture based on demonization, anything goes, and thus begins the process of the prison industrial complex. In LA alone, cases have come out involving cop violence, rampant criminality, perjury, and murder. Cops there have pulled drug heists, have then turned around and sold drugs, have shot and killed unarmed men, and then went to court, sworn on their Bible, and lied like shameless whores. Is this new? Not by a long shot. And the DAs, the judges, the public defenders, the mayor, city council, and other public officials know about it, yet they turn their head and close their eyes. The cops are not the problem. They are the symptom of a total systemic disease, one which sacrifices the poor, the Mexican, the African American, and the powerless to the system. It is in this context, then, that one must examine the rising incidence and severity of cop violence. Why do we speak of police brutality? Why not call it what it is? It is police terrorism. And the state is not a solution to the problem. Indeed, it is the problem. The poor, the black and Chicano, are subjected to this campaign of terror to keep them contained in the ghettos of the community. But we view the violence of that state far differently from retail violence, as activist Larvester Gaither points out in the book called States of Confinement, published recently by St. Martin's Press. I quote, "In recent years, reports of police brutality have become routine. Yet most of the corporate-owned media has focused on hate groups, such as the Ku Klux Klan or the Aryan Nation. This has largely obscured police brutality and racism within the criminal justice system. By situating anti-black vigilantism and state-sanctioned violence in the same framework, we can better devise strategies that allow us to move one step closer to, without moving 2 steps backward from, the solution." Unquote. We will hear, no doubt, of a new and improved police commission to study the latest reign of police criminality, and it'll be equally as successful as those of the past. It is important for us to understand the role of the cops, as they serve not the people, but the rulers. Indeed, they admit as much. Think of the last time that there was a shooting of a so-called citizen by the cops. What do they say? We were just doing our jobs.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's eloquence has caused him to become a much sought-after speaker at college graduations and a variety of marches and demonstrations. In this final piece, recorded in early October for the Million Family March, Abu-Jamal gives a history lesson as he compares today's prison industrial complex with slavery.
Our history here, on the shores of what would later be called North America, begins, for most of us, with the destruction of family. In traditional African societies, the very notion of who a person is determined by family ancestry. When an African person spoke of his tribe or clan, he was describing a large group of people descended from a common ancient ancestor. The American experience meant the severing of tribe from tribe, of clan from clan, of father from son, of wife from husband, of mother from child, of a people from their land. How many of our brothers, our sisters, our clansmen, our people were separated in shackles and sent to Haiti, to Brazil, to Cuba, to the Bahamas, to Suriname, and beyond? What was important to the Americans, to the British, to the Spanish, to the French, and to the Portuguese was not the people, but profit. Why is that important today, over 300 years later? There's an old saying that we've all heard before. It's history repeats itself. Well, a truer, more accurate saying might be history repeats itself, but in different ways. Look at our present condition, and you'll see not slavery, but a legalized descendant, the prison industrial complex, where African Americans and other people of color form a disproportionate percentage of those encaged within the system. America, with something like 6% of the world's population, has over 24% of the world's prison population. With over 2 million men, women, and juveniles in cages, perhaps most for nonviolent drug offenses. This America, which boasts of being the land of the free, is the prison house of nations, an empire built not on liberty, but on repression. And once again, what matters is not the people, but profit. For as radical scholar activist Angela Davis explains, prison construction is a very big business. Billions of dollars for prisons, while schools crumble and teachers bargain or beg for decent pay. Billions of bucks for prison, while homes and buildings crumble in Philadelphia and New York. What also crumbles are families, as children are separated from parents, as wives are separated from husbands, and people are separated from their communities. All at the hands of a system that is demonstrably unjust and riddled with class and racial disparities. You are all perhaps aware of numerous studies which document such disparities, but studies don't change policies, and the American policy of caging, repressing, and devaluing black life is centuries old. History repeats itself, but in different ways. It is our challenge to construct, to build a new history, one where the liberation of our people is central. We can think as tribes did, as the so-called Indians did, and we will fail. Or we can think as a people, utilizing the precious tool of unity. The late, great Malcolm X explained that our oppression didn't stem from our various religious, political, or fraternal associations, but from our being black in a white supremacist and racist nation. That truth has not changed. Do you really think that voting for one or the other politician that's running for president will really mean anything close to liberation for our people? The party which once carried Lincoln's flag is now the party of the right wing. The party which now claims most black voters once called itself openly the white man's party. They've changed masks, but their objectives remain the same, white supremacy. The politics of the prison industrial complex, the politics of the death penalty, the politics of repression. You think that'll change because you pull a little tiny lever in November? Change will come when we fight for our families, for as Frederick Douglass taught us, power concedes nothing without demand. He also taught us without struggle. There is no progress. When the government attacked MOVE on May 13, 1985, killing 11 men, women, and children, what did they care about family? Did it matter that the mayor was black? Did it matter that he was a Democrat? Legendary revolutionary John Africa wrote in his Judges letter, and I quote, "It is insane not to resist something that gives nothing but sickness to you, your mothers, your fathers, your babies, your family," unquote. When the state and big corporations allow and place incinerators in black and Hispanic neighborhoods, when the worst and least nutritious foods are sold in food markets and bodegas, when trees are cut down and schools become mere training grounds for burgeoning rural prisons, when toxic images are pumped into young, impressionable minds, which glorify gangsterism, pimping, and mindlessly shaking booty, when racist, twisted cops look at a man standing on a stoop and automatically seize a suspect, when the state wages what is, in fact, an undeclared war on the poor, well, you have some serious sickness that needs to be resisted. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. You've been listening to the commentary of Mumia Abu-Jamal on Death Row in Pennsylvania. To purchase Abu-Jamal's books, Death Blossoms and Live from Death Row, call Plow Publishing at 1-800-521-8011 or visit www.plow.com. To purchase compact discs of Abu-Jamal's commentary recorded live in Pennsylvania's prisons, call the Prison Radio Project at area code 415-648-4505 or visit www.prisonradio.org. For cassette copies of this program, give us a call at 1-800-778-8461. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a Christian movement dedicated to nonviolence, communal living, and justice. Members pool their time and talents and share all goods and property in common. For more information about the Bruderhof Communities and Bruderhof Radio, call 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 1-800-778-8461. Or visit our website at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof.